By the way, I saw your subscription to Homemaker's Companion lapsed, so I signed you up for a renewal. Helped push me over the top. I hate those things. That ain't the point. Her mother at the call center, pushing magazine subscriptions. Moss drank her rum and cherry coke in the living room, took her place on the leather love seat, her mother reclining on the full-size couch. Moss had almost gone to work for the call center. Her mother had pulled some strings with the manager, but Moss had blown off the chance. That near miss of a career was one of the few true forks in the road she'd traveled. Fashionable to think of a multiverse consisting of infinite directions, infinite paths. But the forking paths weren't truly innumerable, she knew. There were only so many options available to most people, especially girls who grew up poor. Had she taken the job at the call center, she could have turned out just like her mother. She would have made a good alcoholic, she always thought. Call centers and bars and sleeping with whoever was willing to pay her tab for the night. Sometimes she thought of that lifestyle with disgust. Other times she found comfort in the daydream, wishing she could have just lived a regular life of men and stress and shit jobs. A quarto-sized framed picture of Moss's father stood on the mantel above the television. His smile was more a smirk, but the glint in his eye hinted he'd keep on laughing forever, wherever he was. Moss had grown up with this strange, formal picture of her father as a young man who was younger in the photograph than her memories of him. He had been in the Navy, and in the photograph he wore his dress whites. When she thought of the call center, or thought over the ways her life might have been different, or wondered why she had joined NCIS, she sometimes told herself she was searching for her father. But that was a bullshit answer, she knew it. He had left the Navy before she was born. He had left the family when Moss was 5. "We can watch The X-Files," said her mother. "I know you like that show." Sunday nights were Scully nights, but tonight's was a repeat. Fallen Angel. The episode a Mulder episode. So Moss told her mother to flip channels if she wanted. Her mother a news hawk. Headline news interrupted by CNN's breaking story banner. Rapper dead was blunt enough, though. They followed with a headline released from the LA Times. Gangsta rap performer Notorious B.I.G. slain. 4 shots fired through the side of his SUV. A black GMC Suburban roped off by police tape. Her mother sat up. "Oh, damn," she said. "Damn it. I've got to call Shelley. She loves him."
"I think I'm heading to bed," said Moss.
Her mother waving goodnight, but staring mournfully at the screen. Moss's old bedroom had been converted into her mother's junk room over the years, but the spool-turned Jenny Lind bed that had once been her grandmother's had been kept. And the bookshelves still had a few of her old books. The Black Stallion, A Wrinkle in Time, some choose-your-own-adventure books with the death scenes dog-eared. The rocking chair was covered with boxes of clothes. She turned out the lights, thinking she would fall immediately asleep. But the news of the rapper's death bothered her, mixed with the heaviness already in her heart. Moss felt like the world was dissolving. She had the sensation of constellations disappearing from the sky. "Nestor," she said, thinking of the immortality of souls, the resurrection of the body. Nestor's naivety, the ignorance of his faith, but still trying the sound of his name, how it started on the tip of her tongue and worked its way back. In the darkness of her bedroom, surrounded by familiar shadows, she imagined the world around her buried under snow and blizzard winds, the only warmth the pocket beneath her comforter where she lay curled. The muffled sound of the distant television, the sound of her mother's voice speaking on the kitchen telephone. Sounds from her childhood. Easy enough to convince herself she was still just a child, a little girl in her bed, that her entire life was nothing but a strange dream. And if she were to wake now, she would wake years younger, everything as it was 25 years ago. She felt like an interloper on her own past, and so reached to touch her left thigh, run her fingers along the bumps of bone and scarred skin tissue of her stump, reminding herself of who she was now,
Her mother must be calling everyone about the news she was watching. Moss loved the sound of her mother's laughter. How casually she made lasting friendships. How she gave of herself freely, unguarded. Moss too easily became entangled. She tossed in the twin bed, thinking. Thinking again of Nestor. Never able to spark casual relationships like her mother. Never one for trysts. Moss's infatuations developed suddenly. Her emotions came with thistles, like a burr. Once a photographer, he had mentioned, and Moss wondered at that. She wondered who he was, if he was always so pious. Anyway, annoyed at how he'd reduced the deaths of children to Christian bathos about eternity, but nevertheless she wondered at the women in his life. Wondered if there was one. She tried to remember if he had worn a ring. Nestor. The glare of headlights on her ceiling, fragmented by her window, made her remember mirrored images of Elric Fleece and skeletons in the trees. A ship named Libra disappearing into deep waters, lost sailors returning. A dissected black bear swathed in maggots. A trick Moss had taught herself for falling asleep was to imagine a river of black water. She would stand naked before wading into the river, the water creeping to her knees, her thighs, black as ink against her white skin, stomach, her breasts. And soon the water would be above her head, the wavering sunlight disappearing over her, falling deeper into ever-expanding darkness. When she drowned, she slept. A telephone ringing, the tone of her cell on her nightstand.
Hello?
She said.
This is Brock.
Red digits hovering in the dark. 247.
One of our guys just called about the pager you and Nestor recovered at Elric Fleece's residence,
said Brock.
Figured something out.
Tell me.
We found saved pages. No phone numbers, only codes. We haven't figured out what most of the codes are, but we did find a few that repeated. 143 and 607. My guys tell me codes like these are shorthand for I love you or I miss you, things like that. Teenagers use them.
Marcelt and the woman in the Polaroid photograph scheduling times to meet, maybe using codes learned from his daughters.
Having an affair, said Moss. There were 24 pictures of a woman.
We checked Marcelt's home phone records against the pager and found a correlation,
said Brock.
Several times when the pager received the code 22, he placed a call to the Blackwater Falls Lodge, down in Tucker County.
Blackwater Gorge was familiar, a section of the massive Monongahela National Forest, touristy and accessible because of the stunning waterfalls like pearls on the string of the Blackwater River. Moss had once stayed for a week in the lodge, exploring the miles of trails through the gorge, grueling treks with her prosthesis over uneven terrain, searching the Red Run branch of the Dry Fork River, where she had been rescued from her near death in the terminus. She had looked for the part of the river where she had hanged, had searched for the ashen tree she remembered, the burnt white tree that had seemed to repeat. But she never found the site of her crucifixion. She'd returned to the cabins around Blackwater Falls often in her summers, losing herself on the trails, gazing for hours at the crashing eddies and whirling pools of the Ellicottola Falls, reminding herself of the beauty of the world, when it was so easy for her to remember this landscape as desolation and ice.
That lodge is a few hours from here, but would be a good place to meet someone, she said.
Romantic. Remote.
Marcelt called the lodge dozens of times, twice in the last month,
said Brock.
I called over to the lodge, but the clerk didn't have records for anyone named Patrick Marcelt. I'll call the Tucker County Sheriff's Department first thing in the morning, see if they can send someone out.
I'll head over, said Moss, doubtful she'd be able to get back to sleep. I'm in Cannonsburg. I can make it out there. I need to head home out that way.
Her mother snoring from across the hall. Moss crept downstairs feeling like a teenager again, sneaking out in the middle of the night. She remembered which stairs creaked, knew where to put her weight to stay silent. She brewed a pot of coffee in the kitchen, splashed water on her face to wake up.
Marion Mersault was 3 days gone. Last seen this past Friday. Monday morning would dawn in just a few hours. A bottle of aspirin above the sink. Moss took the pills with coffee. She drove the dead-hour interstates, Cannonsburg to 79 South, West Virginia, allowing images to swirl in her mind, glom together. The Challenger in the immensity of the sky. A ship for the dead built of fingernails. The forest in winter. The interstate was a river of asphalt illuminated by street lamp light. She was aware that the mountains grew around her, but she couldn't see them. They were gargantuan darkness, snuffing out the stars. A serpentine cut through pine woods that opened into a parking lot. Only a sparse few cars parked here. The lodge was built like a longhouse, red-roofed, with an exposed stone chimney stack crowning the front entrance. Moss made her way through the vacant lobby, a dropped ceiling and a cream tile floor, the front desk the color of natural cherry wood, everything bathed in garish fluorescence. Moss lingered for a few moments at the unattended front desk, peering behind the counter into an empty manager's office. "Hello," she said, the murmur of a distant television. She followed the sound around to the hotel bar, where varicolored liquors lined the mirror-backed shelves. A young woman sat alone drinking coffee, looking over a Vogue piece about the Spice Girls. She was willowy, in knee socks and a skirt embroidered with a forest scene, deer and rabbits, wildflowers. Her lip and eyebrow pierced with silver rings, her hair voluminous save for the shaved sides, dyed a jolting shade of electric blue.
"Excuse me," said Moss.
"Sorry," said the young woman. "I should be at the desk." "Are you in charge here?" asked Moss.
"Checking in?"
she asked.
"We should have rooms available."
Maybe in her early 20s, just out of college, or maybe this was a student job. Fine features and dark, lovely eyes. Moss held out her identification.
"NCIS," she said.
"I'm wondering if you can answer a few questions for me. Maybe help me out?"
"Are you, like, a cop?"
the young woman asked.
"Naval Criminal Investigative Service," said Moss. "I'm a federal agent investigating crimes relating to the Navy."
That explanation often calmed people who might otherwise have feared becoming entangled in police business. NCIS something remote, harmless seeming to people with no connection to the armed forces.
"Like the FBI?" she asked. "Someone just called here a little bit ago."
"I'm not the FBI," said Moss.
"I'll see what I can do," said the young woman. "I can serve alcohol if you want a drink. Or coffee. I just brewed a fresh pot."
"Coffee, thank you. I don't normally keep these hours."
"I feel like a vampire sometimes," she said, heading behind the bar to pour Moss's cup.
She set out sugar in a carton of half and half.
"Petal, by the way."
"Petal?" said Moss. "That's beautiful."
"Shannon." "Skeleton crew tonight," said Petal. "Got the lobby to myself. More staff will show up closer to breakfast."
"You work here regularly?" asked Moss.
"Most nights," said Petal. "Two nights off a week, not necessarily together. Hard to plan a life with no real weekends. And it's boring. I'm glad you showed up. Gives me something to do."
"Do you know someone named Marion Mersault? Or Patrick Mersault?" asked Moss.
"They aren't familiar names," she said.
"I believe Patrick Mersault may have stayed here frequently," said Moss.
"What kind of information do you keep on file about your guests?"
"Basic stuff," said Petal. "Name, how many people are checking in, that sort of thing. Credit card number unless they pay with cash."
"Phone calls from the room? Incidental costs, damages?"
"Sure," said Petal.
Moss showed Petal a photograph of Mersault.
"Do you recognize him?" she asked.
Petal scrutinized the picture.
"No," she said. "But I don't have a lot of contact with our guests at my hours. Most people check in before I'm here, check out after I leave. And most of the time they're out through the forest hiking. I see people occasionally at breakfast if I stick around to eat."
"I have dates this man would have stayed here over the past year or so," said Moss.
"And the phone number he used to make the reservations."
The phone number wouldn't be much help, said Petal. The dates, though, we could try to cross-check by date.
You can run a search like that on the computer?
Oh, no, said Petal. Our computer system is non-existent. Ever play memory?
They sat up in the lounge on either side of a glass table, sitting by a fire that Petal had kindled in the stone fireplace, several file folders arranged between them by date. Each folder contained a stack of receipts from past occupants, some handwritten. Moss started with the lightest folder, flipping through names, credit card numbers, room numbers, information blurring together as she read. No Patrick Mersault.
Read the names out loud so I can hear them, said Petal. Or, don't bother with the names. Let's stick to credit card numbers. I have an idea. Give me the last four numbers, and I'll write them down. We'll check for duplicates.
All right, said Moss, unaccustomed to receiving this level of engagement. But Petal seemed particularly game, readying her notebook, starting a new column next to a poem she'd been writing. Moss read out the credit card numbers, and Petal checked each number against her list, looking for repeats. They worked for nearly 40 minutes, taking a break only to refill their coffee.
Wait, wait. Can you give me that last one again?
Asked Petal. Moss repeated the number and Petal said,
Here we go.
Yes,
I found a match. Here, Patrick Gannon.
Patrick Gannon, said Moss. Moss jotted down the credit card number that Patrick Gannon had used to make his reservation. He hadn't reserved a room in the lodge, but rather one of the cabins along the south rim of the gorge. Cabin number 22. The same number as the code on his pager. She had him. She checked all the past receipts. The number of guests was listed as 2, though there was no information on the second guest.
Anything unique about that cabin? Moss asked. About the name Gannon? Maybe someone you work with might have an idea about him? Might remember him?
I'll ask around when the morning shift clocks in, said Petal,
tying her bright blue hair into a loose knot.
Let me check the file for cabin 22, see if we've kept any notes about it.
Are you in college? Asked Moss as Petal gathered up their paperwork.
I'm working a few years, said Petal. Not sure if I want to go to school. I wanted to backpack across Africa, but my dad found me this job.
Consider a career in law enforcement, said Moss. You're a natural. You've been a help tonight. Petal replaced the files of room receipts in the management office before stepping behind the front desk, opening up the 3-ring binder labeled cabins. She flipped to the back, scanned a series of forms.
Wasp's nest in cabin 22 in 1983, said Petal. Looks like it was taken care of.
She opened another 3-ring binder labeled check-in, said.
Oh, shit! Gannon's checked in right now. Cabin 22.
Tonight? Said Moss, a prickle of adrenaline. She thought of Marion, wondered if she was in one of the cabins, possibly held here. Petal checked a pegboard full of keys on the rear wall, checked again in her binder.
He made the reservation Friday night, checked in Saturday, and has the cabin through the week.
A Friday night reservation. He'd booked his cabin just as Marion had been kidnapped.
I need to get there, said Moss. No moment to spare if she might recover Marion here, now.
I can follow one of the roads that lead from the parking lot. About a mile from here, said Petal. It's tricky in the dark. I can take you over.
Petal threw on a peacoat, brought Moss through the administrative office to the garage, where she found a golf cart spattered with mud. They left the garage and rode along the cabin path, a winding strip of concrete lit only by the dim wattage of the golf cart's front light. Moss gripped the crossbar as Petal drove, taking the bends quickly. The stars were thick out here, without the diluting light of cities. Orion and the Dippers were clear, but the sky was dominated by the silvery flare of the comet Hale-Bopp, the cosmic ice and burning tails like a thumb smudge of light. 2 dozen cabins were situated near the gorge rim, each private, separated by dense hemlocks. A few were booked, Moss figured, seeing cars tucked into the woods. But most of the cabins stood empty. March was still too cold for most people. Petal drove around to one of the distant cabins.
Here's 22, she said.
A Wrangler was parked in the gravel patch, the spare tire draped with a POW MIA cover. No lights. The cabin seemed consumed by night.
Petal, go ahead and wait back here, all right? Said Moss, standing from the golf cart.
Petal bundled up in her coat, lit a cigarette. Marion might be here, thought Moss. She picked her way along the mulch path to the cabin. The night was so opaque she could barely see Petal in the golf cart, could see only the orange tip of her cigarette bobbing like a firefly.
Moss knocked on the door, waiting a few moments.
Nothing stirred inside the cabin. No light snapped on, no movement. She knocked harder.
Special Agent, NCIS, she said. I need to speak with Patrick Mersault.
Silence. She unsnapped her holster, ready to draw. Moss knocked again, no answer. Or maybe there was no one here. The cabins were small enough, she should have heard movement if someone were inside.
Do you have keys?
Moss called back.
Yeah, said Petal. I have to open the door for you. I can't hand over the manager's keys.
Moss watched the cigarette tip bob closer. Petal had a ring of keys, squinted to find the one marked 22.
I wish I had a flashlight, she said, stepping around Moss, feeling for the cabin lock with her fingers.
Moss heard the key slide in, heard the lock unlatch. Petal stepped inside just as Moss was smacked by the odor of blood.
Petal, don't!
Petal flipped on the lights, and when she registered the wash of blood, she screamed, her cigarette dropping from her mouth. Moss took the girl by her shoulders, held her, led her from the cabin.
It's okay. It's okay. Go back to the office, call 911. I'm all right, said Petal, her voice bubbling with hysteria. I'm all right. It's fine. I didn't see it. I didn't see...
Moss put her hands to Petal's cheeks, steadied her.
Listen to me. Listen, she said,
and registered the moment when Petal regained herself.
Go back to the office. Call 911, said Moss. My cell won't work out here. I need you to do this for me, okay? Call 911.
Moss waited until she heard the sound of the golf cart's motor diminish before returning to the cabin. She crushed out Petal's cigarette, smoldering on the floor. She closed the door behind her. The cabin's interior was wood, with exposed ceiling beams. Patrick Mersault's body was beside the bed, his head resting on the mattress, his wrists tied behind him with a belt. Someone had shot him through the back of the head. An execution. Blood had sprayed from the exit wound, dousing the headboard with blood that glistened in the room lights. She checked the rest of the cabin. There was no one else here. No sign of Marion. Mersault had been staying here alone. She spotted a gun on the floor. A Beretta M9. Could be a service weapon, she thought, wondering if the Beretta had been Mersault's or if his killer had left it here. But even if it was his service weapon, the NSC SEAL she worked with strongly preferred the Sig Sauer P226. The M9 might have been the weapon Mersault was originally issued back in the mid-80s, an older gun. She heard sirens piercing the silence long before they arrived. The first on scene was an ambulance from the Broadus Hospital, Moss waiting outside the cabin, waving off the EMTs so they wouldn't contaminate the crime scene. When the Tucker County Sheriff arrived, Moss asked him to radio in, ask for the FBI. Deputies woke the few others in the cabins, taking their names, contact information, asking them what they might have heard, what they might have seen. An FBI unit from the Clarksburg field office arrived, already in contact with Brock, who was on his way down from Pittsburgh. No cell reception here, but Petal let Moss use the office telephone. The lodge office was stuffy, with a minuscule metal writing desk and a calendar of the Blackwater Falls photographed in different seasons. Moss dialed for an outline. At this hour, O'Connor must be asleep, she figured, so she tried his home number rather than NCIS headquarters. She thought of him now. Wisps of white hair, sandpaper stubble, sitting up in bed and shuffling through his vast house in Virginia, chasing down the ringing telephone before his younger wife's sleep was disturbed.
O'Connor,
he said. Moss, she said. I located him. Patrick Mersault's dead. I'm calling from the Blackwater Falls Lodge in West Virginia. He had a cabin here.
Homicide?
O'Connor asked. He was shot through the back of the head, said Moss. Wrists tied behind him.
an execution. I don't think Mersault killed his family. Someone hunted him down, killed them all. We still have no leads about his daughter.
The FBI will handle the search for Marion, said O'Connor. Our primary concern remains Patrick Mersault and Elric Fleece. I spoke with Special Agent Nestor earlier, pulled Fleece's record. Navy, electrician's mate, submarines in the late 70s, NSC in 81, Zodiac.
Libra? Asked Moss.
That's right. We need to find out what these men were involved in, why they weren't on the ship. We need to know about Libra. I'm meeting with the NSC director tomorrow, Admiral Ansley.
There's something else, said Moss. Fleece had seen the Terminus, or knew about it. His place was... His property was decorated with sculptures of the hanged men. I think he had seen the future. Remember when I lost my leg? I had that confusion about the reflections. Do you remember? I thought I'd seen myself.
Of course, said O'Connor.
That time of her life delicate between them. How what should have been a routine training exercise in the Canaan Valley had resulted in the loss of her limb. He'd been inconsolable when the medical staff of the William McKinley mentioned amputation as the only way to save Moss from gangrene, and had been present during the two surgeries needed to remove her leg at the thigh. This man, Fleece, had made a sculpture of the reflections, she said. I can't explain it, but he knew. I've been thinking Mersault never sailed on Libra, never made the assignment. But if Fleece knows the Terminus... A pause on O'Connor's end.
We need to get out ahead of this investigation. It's spreading like wildfire. We have to contain it, he said. I have to move you to the future on this one.
Moss's jaw clenched at his words, her shoulders tightened. Traveling to Ifs took a toll on her body, years of her life spent in futures. She had lost relationships the last time she was called on to travel, had a boyfriend she imagined a life with. But when she traveled, she had left her boyfriend's bed one morning and returned within the week, aged 4 years, distant from him, her heart and mind already long past the moment she'd been living. Just give me a few more days, she said. We have leads. There are pictures of a woman.
I'm moving you on this, said O'Connor. I have to. Mersault turning up like this, and now Fleece. They're a national security risk, Shannon. We need to know about these men now. We need to know about Libra.
20 years from now, this current investigation will have concluded. Everything happening here will be history. With any luck, whoever murdered Mersault and his family will have been captured. Mersault's missing in action status will have been explained, his connection to Libra understood. Moss might arrive 20 years from now and be handed a folder with every question answered, every opaqueness made clear. A framed photograph of the Blackwater Lodge staff stood on the desk. Moss picked out Petal, her hair not blue in this picture, her natural color a dark shade, almost black. Marion, thought Moss. You can find Marion. All right. I'll get ahead of this thing, she said. She was unable to slide backward through time to prevent Marion's disappearance, the butchery to her family. But she could travel forward to learn what had happened to her, or what might happen to her. Maybe I can save her, she thought. Maybe we're not too late. I'll go, she said. I'll leave from here. Can make it to Oceana by mid-morning.
I'll make arrangements, said O'Connor.
Moss found Petal at the front desk. The young woman had been crying, her eyes pinkish, but she had collected herself. Already this world, terra firma, seemed to Moss like a distant recollection, like it belonged to a past age, bathed in a haze of memory. Even Petal seemed like someone remembered from long ago. Moss handed her one of her business cards, said, "This is my name, here, Shannon Moss." When the sheriff's department or someone from the FBI asks you about what happened tonight, make sure you talk with Special Agent William Brock of the FBI. Tell him everything. Brock, said Petal. Okay.
You've done great, said Moss. Hang in there.
Moss pulled away from the Blackwater Falls Lodge. She turned on the radio to drown out her thoughts, the tuner scanning, picking up static channels. Moss listened to the white noise, the night burning with stars. The vast body of heaven, the body of the woman in the Polaroid photographs. There had been a woman who'd met Mersault in the Blackwater cabin, who had known him, had been intimate with him. Who was she? Moss thought of that unknown woman. She thought of Marion. She thought about the search parties that would comb through these woods in the coming days. Men and women searching tight grids, looking for a sign of the girl somewhere among the pines. Maybe they would find her. Maybe they would pull Marion's body from the soil. Or maybe they would find her months from now, wasted away and desecrated by wildlife. Or maybe they would never find her. The pine woods stretched out like a vast, dark sea on either side of Moss. She thought of Marion. She thought of Courtney. She imagined Courtney wandering alone, lost among the pines. Her thoughts of Courtney were so vivid, Moss felt she could almost see her, a blur of white among the subsuming darkness of the woods. A girl lost, lost and so far from home, lost in the eternal forest, lost forever. Part 2, 2015 to 2016. I will invite myself to this ghost supper. August Strindberg, The Ghost Sonata. 1.
Grey Dove, actual on your go?
Go, I said. The engines fired. I was pressed into my chair, hurtling along the runway, and as the Grey Dove lifted into the night, my belly flopped at her steep ascent. The earth rushed from me. The Grey Dove rattled around me, shaking me. I used to pass out as she climbed, the G-forces whipping blood from my brain. But I'm used to her now, and grip the chair and watch the lights of cities as they recede below, turning into skeins of light as delicate as illuminated webs as they disappear from my view, replaced by the vast blackness of the ocean at night.
Grey Dove, please dim the lights, I said.
The cockpit lights go dark, and the heads-up display vanishes, and far above any cloud cover or light pollution, the stars reveal themselves, countless points of brilliance, overwhelming beauty.
Bird in flight's looking good, all systems go,
from the Apollo Suchet Tower. And the Grey Dove climbs ever steeper, and I'm soon facing upward, on my back, the earth directly beneath me. The nuclear thrusters fire and the sudden force crushes me, difficult to draw breath. But the pain lasts only a few seconds, 30 seconds at most, before Grey Dove escapes Earth's clutching gravity and I'm weightless. The earth dwindles beneath me, behind me. I feel the rumble of the firing thrusters vibrate through the ship, and I feel like I'm falling, like everything's floating and falling. The lunar approach was a trip of only a few hours, but I didn't dock at the Black Veil. I accelerated past the moon. And as the moon's silver face diminished, darkening, the Black Veil's lighthouse tower locked into the Grey Dove's computer and performed a final check of the Brandt LaMonaco quantum foam macro field generator. The Grey Dove entered the area of space NSC called Danger Sector, as it was pocked with BL space time knots, points of instability created by BL engines as we sail deep waters. The BL drive switch lit green. I peered through the Grey Dove's cockpit glass back toward Earth, like a sailor stealing her final glimpse of shore. Earth in the ocean of space, a tearful rush, a vast sense of the fragility of life. These were the rare moments I felt a spiritual swell. March 1997, I said, reminding myself of what I was soon to leave, and flipped the switch. The BL drive fired, creating a quantum foam macro field. For a brief moment, I felt as if all future possibilities existed with me, a melancholy sweetness that dissipated. A Q-foam macro field was nothing I'd ever see, even if the Grey Dove had been enveloped within one, a roiling system of wormholes flashing into existence and collapsing out of existence, all in just a planked unit of time. The earth, moon, and stars were blacked out. I sailed a wormhole. Which wormhole out of that turbulent foam the gray dove penetrated was just a matter of chance. Each a tunnel to a distinct tine of the future multiverse. I would sail 3 months through the quantum foam, the only light the gray dove's cabin lights. Outside was depthless darkness. Void. I unstrapped from the cockpit, the sounds I made strange in that eerie silence. I floated into the larger section of the ship, the interior curvilinear, white. A solitary passage. I read my case notes, reread them, and as days passed, I cycled through the ship's library of films. Gene Seberg, Bardot, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and listened to The Cure and Shania Twain and Nirvana, long stretches of classical music, Rachmaninoff, Ravel. Diminishing muscle and bone mass a constant concern without gravity, so my daily routine was to exercise, fastening myself to the treadmill with broad shoulder straps, jogging with my prosthesis, elastic bands and vacuum resistance, miles of stairs climbed on the elliptical. A 3-month journey to travel 19 years. I was startled when the Gray Dove's alarm sounded, alerting me that she had made contact with the Black Veil's lighthouse, that a new existence had coalesced around me. I dressed in my flight suit and floated to the cockpit, buckling myself in. Earth had reappeared in the void, as if a blue light had been switched on. I checked the heads-up display. September 2015. Relieved that my voyage was closing, but arrivals were different from departures. No exhilaration at seeing home after so long an absence. Rather, seeing this future Earth was like staring into a mirror and discovering someone else's face. Approaching Naval Air Station Oceana from the Atlantic, 2 a.m., the gray dove a needle passing over the black fabric of ocean. Rain swept cockpit windows, lights of distant ships bobbing in the breakers, the coastline of Virginia much brighter than I remembered, even in this dismal weather.
"Oceana, approach," I said, calling to the airfield. "Cormorant 707 Golf Delta, level 15,000 with information kilo."
A blast of static, a woman's voice.
"Cormorant 707 Golf Delta, Oceana, approach. Turn left heading 320. Descend and maintain 9,000.
First voices on arrival were always eerie, echoes of sounds that hadn't yet been struck. The woman on the comm might have been only a child in 1997, or, if she was young enough here, might not have been born, might not ever be born. Her entire life was only a possibility of the conditions of 1997, nothing more, brought into existence by my arrival. Blinking out when I leave. She was a ghost, haunting her own potential. Before experiencing ifs, I imagined time travel as something concrete, that knowing the future would be as certain as knowing the past. I imagined that knowing the future might help me cheat at something like the lottery, seeing winning numbers before the numbers were ever pulled. This was before attending lectures at the Black Veil, before struggling through the mathematics-laden booklet explaining the physics of the Brandt-LaMonaco quantum foam macro field generator. When I mentioned the lottery to our instructor, he'd said that every lottery number existed as a possible winning number until the moment when the winning numbers were observably pulled. What I would experience when traveling to an if, he'd said, wouldn't be the actual observed outcome of the lottery, but only a possibility of the winning numbers.
"In other words," he'd said, "don't place your bets."
"Cormorant 7 Golf Delta," said the flight controller. "Intercept the localizer runway 28 right. Cleared ILS 28 right."
Reflections of raindrops were like shadows boiling on my flight suit. I followed the ramp handler's neon batons taxiing. What would one day be real? Ifs felt like being lost in a house with a floor plan similar to your own, returning and returning to not quite familiar corridors, not quite familiar rooms. A team of engineers surrounded the gray dove once she was through the hangar doors. They wore reflective vests marked Net Warcom and tended to the BL drive, housed in the ship's engine room, astern. A ladder rigged to the cockpit, One of the engineers knocked on the canopy of glass.
"Welcome to Apollo Suchek,"
he shouted.
"Naval Air Station Oceana."
I unlocked and lifted the canopy, an irrational panic at the prospect of breathing hypothetical air, holding my breath as I removed my breathing mask, savoring my last breath from the oxygen tank until I couldn't hold out any longer and filled my lungs with the place. Unused to the pull of gravity, as I tried to unbuckle and climb from the cockpit, gravity like hooks tugging downward. The NetWarcom engineer draped my arm over his shoulder, assisted me from the flight chair, down the ladder rig. I'd lost weight in my 3 months aboard the Grey Dove. My prosthesis had lost its proper fit. The engineer eased me into a waiting wheelchair. I felt like I'd only closed my eyes, but when lights swarmed back, I'd already been moved from the hangar and hooked up to an IV for hydration. A medical facility. A hospital room. A team of nurses, two men, transferred me from the wheelchair to a firm mattress, handling me like I weighed little more than a husk. Weary. My body felt like it was shutting down. A blush of modesty as they undressed me, removing my sweat-sodden flight suit, my underclothes. The last thing I remember before depths of sleep swallowed me was saying, "At least change the channel." The flat television tuned to The X-Files, an episode I'd never seen. 2 weeks shy of six when my father left us. Mom moved her rocker into my room and sat with me until I fell asleep, each night saying the Sandman would come and sprinkle dreams in my eyes. When once I asked who the Sandman was, she told me he was a shadow who crept into rooms where children slept, bringing dreams to kind children, removing the eyes from children who were rotten. When I asked what the Sandman did with those eyes, she said he passed them on to children waiting to be born so they would have eyes to see. Every night when I closed my eyes, I heard Mom rocking in her chair and feared the Sandman would come for my eyes, and although I was used to falling asleep with the thought of the Sandman approaching, every night the fear was new. Time travel evoked similar anxieties. I had traveled to Ith 7 times before, but never grew used to the dread of existing in a future. I was a splinter of the real that had pierced the membrane of a dream. Everything that followed my induction into NCIS had felt dreamlike, following that first moment in the Cormorant when my recruitment class had experienced weightlessness. While we were at the Black Veil, our instructors taught us the riddles of deep time, how we couldn't effectively travel to the past except for those rare occurrences called space-time knots and closed time-like curves, how we can travel to the future, but only possible futures. Only the present is real. Only the present is terra firma. We were warned that no time passes in terra firma while we lived lives in ifs, and yet ifs weren't real, not objectively so. We were told that we affected ifs even as we observed them, that they would bend around our psyches in subtle ways, but as surely as intense gravity bends light. The effect was called lensing, the sensation bizarre. Our instructor saying that ifs could feel like dreams within dreams. One session our instructor had asked us, "What would happen if you met someone in the future and brought him home with you to live in terra firma? What would happen if that person already exists in the present?" Another man had entered the classroom. An exact duplicate of our instructor. A double. A doppelganger. "You would have what we call an echo," the double had said. I woke in the hospital room. "What year is it?" I asked the technician who came to take blood.
2015, she said.
"September?
You haven't been asleep that long. Yeah, it's still September."
Bone density tests, eyesight tests, MRIs, a physical therapy regimen to recover from 3 months without gravity. But I'm a quick study, my body accomplished in adapting to new movement. The routine to manage the effects of gravity was not unlike the physical therapy routine following my amputation. The hours of rehabilitation, when teams of physical and occupational therapists taught me how to live with a missing limb. Severe weight loss aboard the Grey Dove. I hadn't realized just how many pounds I'd shed, but my facial features were drawn. my ribs and the points of my hip bone visible, my figure diminished in the full-length mirror. An enormous appetite. Daily protein shakes, sometimes twice daily. Easy to exceed the recommended caloric intake. In the past 3 months, nothing but protein fillets, Russian Vita sticks, foil envelopes of fruit paste. I'd need to bulk up to endure the return trip home. A soft knock at the room door the afternoon of my fifth day. I thought maybe one of the lab techs for another round of blood work. But when I opened the door, I found a hulking man, slightly stooped with age, bald except for a cottony tonsure and a flowing white beard. He wore a brown suit and a robin's egg pocket handkerchief that matched the vivid blue of his shirt. When he saw me, a grin spread warmly across his face, like the sun revealed from behind clouds.
"Ah, there you are,"
he said.
"I've been waiting nearly 20 years to meet you."
I recognized him. Remembered him when he was middle-aged, a 6.5-foot physicist with a startling mohawk, reed thin back then, in a cardigan and large black-framed glasses. Now hunched and thicker, the top of his head as smooth as a river stone. Dr. Njoku had already been a star investigator by the time I saw him speak at a training session in Savannah because of his work on the Farrier case, a policy setter for investigations involving echoes, those individuals brought from IFS, doubling someone already living. Cases of misconduct among NSC sailors were common, an epidemic of drugs and money stolen from IFS and distributed in terra firma. While fallout from Tailhook reverberated through the Navy, however, NSC sailors went without reform, because actions committed in inadmissible future trajectories had always been considered inadmissible, as if those actions had never occurred. Njoku's work had helped change the culture. He had spent years investigating Petty Officer Jack John Farrier, a sailor authorized to travel solo missions to deep waters, but who had instead made several runs to near futures to kidnap the wives of friends, to bring these doubled women back to terra firma, to defile and eventually murder. Farrier had pleaded innocent, but the court found, based on Njoku's work, that echoes brought to terra firma should be considered alive in every sense, afforded the rights of non-resident aliens. The charges against Farrier stuck, resulting in court-martial and, after a series of appeals, the death sentence.
"Dr. Njoku," I said, shaking his hand. "I'm honored. I heard you speak in Savannah." A summery vitality percolated in his eyes, even though he moved with difficulty. Stiff knees, orthopedic shoes. He held a slim silver laptop, manila envelopes.
"The honor's mine," he said.
"You're a bird in flight, a time traveler. The rest of us are just ghosts. Here, I brought you some housewarming gifts."
Njoku handed me an envelope.
"O'Connor wanted to bring these to you himself, but he just couldn't make the trip. Some health issues."
Mortal revelations were common in IFS, but always jarring.
"I'm sorry," I said, not knowing what else to say. I tried not to imagine O'Connor suffering, told myself that whatever the circumstances here, he was still healthy in 1997.
"He has his good days and his bad days," said Njoku. "He lives out in Arizona. Says the dry air helps. He so wanted to see you again, but some days he can't even speak some days. He endured a series of heart attacks a few years back. He had to send me in his place."
We were trained not to take personal revelations like these as fact, not to let ourselves be snagged with worry over the possibilities we see unspooled. O'Connor's series of heart attacks might not ever occur. I opened the envelope he'd left for me. A visa, a bank card, driver's insurance, and a license. $500 in 20s. A slim profile cellular phone that looked like a handheld television.
"Ever use an ATM?"
Njoku asked. "Sure, but we travel with cash. I brought enough to last."
"Use the debit card. You'll have an endless supply. Save you some paperwork when you return home. Your PIN is 1234. Everything's registered under the name you provided us with."
"State of Virginia license," my photograph taken from my NCIS ID card, altered so that I was a brunette. Courtney Gim. I'd asked O'Connor before I left to have this identification ready, knowing I'd be traveling under a different name. Almost 20 years after I'd filled out the paperwork, here it was.
That one's a burner phone, said Njoku. Disposable. Biodegradable.
You don't have ambient systems here? I asked, thinking of other ifs I'd visited. Futures misty with nanotech, the air shimmering gold like fairy dust, hallucinatory images, illusions, voices that answered when you spoke their names. Cellular phones were obsolete in other futures.
No, nothing like that here, said Njoku.
We shared a pot of oolong tea, watched a video montage on his laptop of what I'd missed in the intervening years. Highlights of the late 20th and early 21st centuries. The death of Diana and the semen-stained dress. The 1,000 dead at the terror attack on the Seegis FBI facility. A bitter jolt seeing images of the office where I worked engulfed in flames. The dead draped in sheets. The election of Gore. The towers falling. An Iraq treaty. The invasions of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Some of these images were familiar from other ifs, but in other ifs, history had played out differently.
What about the Terminus? I asked.
Recorded at the year 2067, by the crew of the USS James Garfield.
Within a lifetime.
Show me that part about Seegis again, I said.
The largest act of domestic terror since the Oklahoma City bombing, said Njoku. Over 1,000 casualties. A sad, terrible day.
Internet images of the immediate aftermath. The dead laid in the field surrounding the Seegis facility and in the vast parking lot. I wondered who I'd known that would be among the dead. Rashonda Brock, it occurred to me. And the kids, Brianna and Jasmine. I wondered if they would have died in the Seegis attack. Thought of Brock just before he'd opened the door to Courtney's old bedroom. I have two beautiful girls, he'd said. His entire family might have been stricken from him in a single morning. My office is in one of the burning sections, I said, my corner of the building obscured by smoke and nearly every image. The sensation was like seeing a house you'd once lived in burn to cinders. I thought of the faces I would have recognized. Rashonda Brock running through corridors opaque with smoke, searching for her children. Was, I corrected. I might die in this attack. Or, I might have died. Except I know.
A suicide bomber. An individual who worked for the FBI. His office was in the Seegis building, said Njoku. He had security clearance.
Then the bomber is employed at Seegis now, I thought. I might have passed him in the hallways. Might have interacted with him. I didn't recognize the photographs of the suicide bomber or his name. Ryan Wrigley Torgerson.
What happened?
April 19th, 1998, he said. Torgerson reported to work like any ordinary day. Breezed through security. He had a bomb sewn inside his body. Nasty stuff. And he'd spent some time planting other bombs in the building. The explosions themselves caused some damage, but he'd rigged the fire suppression system with sarin.
Sarin. Even a whiff of sarin gas was lethal within seconds. Imagining my colleagues in those narrow corridors, sarin spraying from ceiling sprinklers.
Why did this happen? I asked. What was the motive?
Anti-government paranoia, said Njoku. Inspired by Timothy McVeigh, more than likely. Torgerson had purchased blueprints of the Seegis facility from a militia member active in West Virginia. He must have figured that destroying Seegis would cripple government law enforcement.
Njoku refilled our cups with tea, placed two manila envelopes on the table between us, both sealed. One envelope was marked Mersault, Patrick. The other, Mersault, Marion. Whatever hopes I harbored that Marion Mersault would have been found alive, safe, in the years between her disappearance and now, dissolved at the sight of her name. I tore open the seal on Marion's file, slid out the thin sheaf of papers, and wept when I saw a photograph of partially buried bone fragments. A rush of mourning that had pent up in my heart ever since learning that the girl was missing. Marion's remains had been found in the summer of 2004, buried in the vast wilderness of the Blackwater Gorge. A photograph of the site showed a nondescript patch of mud in a verdant forest. Another showed bones in the earth. Despite the recovered remains, no suspects other than her father had ever emerged, and no criminal charges were ever filed. Najoku had collected a few newspaper clippings from the time, the papers already yellowed. Another run of the familiar picture of Marion from the Amber Alert. A few quotes from Brock, reaffirming an already established narrative that Patrick Mersault had murdered his wife and children before killing himself. A confusion there. Patrick Mersault had been executed, clearly a homicide. I scanned the news items, the obituary. Only an aunt and an uncle from Ohio to feel the relief at Marion's discovery, to bear the public grief. And then it was over. The Mersault family filed away. "The file's wrong," I said. "Patrick Mersault was murdered. He didn't kill himself."
"The decision was made by NCIS and the FBI to control the narrative to the public, the media. A story of murder-suicide helped close up outside inquiries. We continued to investigate Mersault's murder, but nothing turned up. The trail ran cold."
"Hikers found her," I said.
"A fluke. Nothing stays buried," said Najoku. "When her remains were discovered, one of our guys reconvened with the FBI, but nothing was discovered to warrant reopening the case."
"She's still alive. Marion might be still alive where I come from," I told him, setting aside Marion's file as if the pages themselves were fragile. I opened the file Mersault, Patrick. A swift boat gunner in Vietnam. The connection to Elric Fleece confirmed. Pictures of the two men together on their boat. Fleece lean, almost unrecognizable from the obese body we'd cut down from the tree made of bones. Younger. The file contained photographs of the mirrored room, the sculptures, the pictures of Kennedy, the Challenger, the swift boat covered in chips of fingernails.
"What about this?" I asked him.
"Anything with the fingernails?"
"They were all Elric Fleece's," said Najoku. "No break there."
"Any guess as to what the ship made of nails to carry the dead is?"
"It should be in the notes. A Viking myth. Something about the end of the world."
I found the annotation. Nokfar. A ship constructed from the fingernails of the dead. Sails the end of the world to wage war against the gods. Another set of photographs. Copies of the 24 explicit Polaroids we had found in Fleece's house, in the duffel bag in his spare room. Nicole Onyango.
"This woman was identified?" I asked. "Who is this?"
"A day or two after Patrick Mersault's body was discovered," said Najoku. "Special Agent Philip Nestor tracked her down, using license plate information the lodge kept, questioned her. But she wasn't involved in our homicides beyond a sexual relationship with Mersault. She'd been having an affair with Mersault for a number of years, but was shocked and saddened by what he was wrapped up in, what happened to his family. I remember she took the news of his death very hard."
Nicole Onyango, a registered nurse at the Donnell House, hospice care associated with a hospital in Washington, Pennsylvania. Her address was up to date. The Castle Tower apartments not far from her place of work. Notes about her life, her routine. It looked like she spent most every day shift at the Donnell House before heading to a nearby bar, the Mayor's Inn, where she drank until walking home at night. One of the pictures in the file was a copy of the woman's work ID. She was stunning, almost intimidating. Her eyes were a light shade of hazel. I compared her work ID to the sex pictures, the same rich color of skin. How did she strike up a relationship with a man like Patrick Mersault?
Nestor interviewed her?
"I'll want to see any paperwork he kept about this woman," I said.
"We can track him down," said Najoku. "He was never briefed about Deep Waters, and he left the FBI some years ago. I
think he sells guns.
Nestor? I asked. Not uncommon for FBI agents to make the jump into a